said an oral history interview how Mr. Edgar S. Willard Jr. in his office at the DuPont Building in Wilmington, Delaware, on June 10, 1999. Mr. Willard, I know from some things I have read that you were born in Washington, North Carolina, April 15, 1934.
Correct.
Can you tell me something about your childhood, your parents?
Well, sure. I had a wonderful childhood, unlike a lot of people nowadays. I had a childhood that was very supportive and very reinforcing. I was born in a little town called Washington, North Carolina, about 8,000 population. Even today, it's still about 8,000 population. So while there's industry now in the eastern part of North Carolina, there was really no industry when I grew up, and still there's very little in my hometown. It was a rural area. Tobacco was king. Most everyone who lived there was a farmer. Grew tobacco or corn, some soybeans and cotton. Delightful little town. We knew everybody. Everybody knew us. My parents were neither poor nor rich. They lived paycheck to paycheck. My mother worked in a drugstore as an accountant, keeping the books, bookkeeper she would call it. My father owned a pool room, but it was really more, excuse me, a quick lunch place than a pool room, because people from all walks of life loved to come. It was named Edgar's. And people from all walks of life love to come to the pool room and have lunch. So I worked with him the whole time I was in high school and summers during college. So that environment, he was very well known and very popular. He was a gregarious guy. One reason his business was so successful. And my mother was very, very smart. She was a valedictorian of her class in 1927. Had one sister. She and I were both very interested in athletics. She played on all the women's basketball teams and other teams they had. And I was fortunate enough to play on all the high school football, basketball, baseball teams. So it was a very happy environment. Washington is on the Pamlico River. So we grew up on the water. We had a little boat and swimming and water skiing and just naturally having a good time as kids. So my mother being very bright, always taught me, helped me, supported me, encouraged me on the academic side, and my dad being gregarious and not that interested in academics, always helped me on the side of getting to know people, understand people, being around people. So it was a great environment to learn a lot of things. It was very secure and safe and friendly environment. You know, in those days you didn't lock your doors, you walked everywhere, and I never had any fear or concern of anything happening day or night. So it'd be hard to beat the life I grew up with.
Your father had the same name as you, and what was your mother's name?
My mother was named Mamie Boone. They always had the joke that they were descended from Daniel. I have no idea whether it's true or not, but we had a good time about it. Yeah, they believed it. But we never spent any time trying to figure it out. Large families. My mother had four sisters and three brothers, and my dad had four sisters and no brothers. So I had lots of aunts and uncles. We got together a lot for picnics and other things on both sides of the family. So once again, I grew up in an environment where it was a big family support. I remember well when I had appendicitis in the, I was about 12 years old, I was in the hospital, and the next morning when the doctor came in to check on me, he said, "I don't know how many more Boones and Willards there are to come in here and see you, but the place has been full for 24 hours. So it was just that kind of family environment where someone's in the hospital or in any kind of trouble, everybody joined in. I just kind of thought that's the way life was.
What were your principal academic interests when you were in high school?
Well, I always loved math. I was very good at math. It was very easy for me, you know, which is really just an asset the Lord gave me, and anything particularly attributable to me personally. But I could always do math very fast and very easily, I think from my mother's genes. As I say, my dad wasn't really interested in that. I remember even back in the first grade where the teacher was giving out addition or multiplication, I just had the ability to do it real fast, and I always raised my hand, and after five or six she would say, "Okay, Edgar, you don't answer now. Let the rest of the class have a chance." So math was really always my great interest, and the second one was history. I haven't really followed up with the history, but I love reading about highly successful people, what motivated them, how they achieved what they did, those who put their talents to very positive accomplishments, and those who were, I even liked reading and learning about those who put their talents into destructive routes. So it was not in physics I liked a lot, but curiously I wasn't really good at chemistry. I had a little chemical set, but even in school I liked it very much, but I wasn't really talented at doing experiments. It was really math and physics and history that the things that drove me to kind of shape where I wanted to go.
When you graduated from high school, did you go immediately to college?
Well, yes, I did. When I was in high school, you know, as I've indicated, growing up in North Carolina, my family, we lived nicely. We had a car and we had plenty of food, and we were just happy as we could be, but we didn't have any real money. It never occurred to me there was any consideration to go anywhere other than a state-supported school in North Carolina. And at that time, while there are many in North Carolina now, at that time, the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and North Carolina State in Raleigh were really the two places that one seriously considered as the premier places to go. I mean, it was Duke, but you know, it was out of the question for us to even consider Duke. So the only question in my mind was which one of those I would go to, and both my math teacher, who I remember very, very well as one of the people who shaped my future, her name was Murdy Cooper, and my physics teacher, Billy Wagner, from, 10th grade on, said, You got to go be an engineer. you'll be a great engineer." And I was impressionable, and it seemed to make a lot of sense. So I pretty well knew that I was going to North Carolina State to be an engineer. Again, my mother and father, while very supportive of whatever I wanted to do, really didn't have any feel for what kind of education I should pursue, so I pinned, and we didn't have any placement offices or anything in school, so I really depend on teachers, and those two were the most influential, mainly because I was very, very good at math, I was very good at physics, I could grasp concepts very well. It bothered me a little because I had so many friends that were very good at repairing cars and stuff like that, which I was pretty inept at. But they assured me that engineering was more about understanding the concepts and how to solve problems than, you know, being a mechanic, a good mechanic, or a good carpenter. So they gave me a great deal of confidence, and it was clear to me from early on that I was going to North Carolina State, which I did as soon as I graduated from high school in 1952. I applied and was accepted at State. I had very good grades in high school and very good references, so really getting in was never a problem. And the tuition in those days was remarkably low. Even on an inflation-adjusted basis, the state really almost paid for the whole thing. So it was fairly easy for me to go and to earn most of my living expenses in various jobs that I held to take care of the room and board. So once again, I had a very great experience at North Carolina State. Our high school in Washington did not have some of the prerequisites. I remember solid geometry. I had to go that summer and take solid geometry and another course to meet the prerequisites to get in. But I started off at NC State in nuclear engineering, which was embryonic in those days, 1953, 52 actually, when I started. And North Carolina State had the first nuclear reactor on any university in the United States, which I thought was very impressive. This was a new science and one that had great appeal to me. So I started in nuclear engineering, not really knowing what I wanted to do, and knowing, in spite of all the admonitions I've been given, that I really wasn't very good in a mechanical sense. I was much better at thinking and solving problems than physically doing things with my hands. So I really liked it very much, and did very well. I had a lot of interests in college. Had a terrific experience. My second year, I joined a fraternity. I was pretty shy up until those days. Not excessively, but I didn't meet people easily. I was very comfortable and gregarious with people I knew, but didn't meet new people easily. So joining the fraternity was excellent for me in two ways. One was it did help me greatly socially, because you're constantly meeting new people. And secondly, it gave me an opportunity to, I ran the dining hall, and then later was the house manager, so I made enough money right in the fraternity, just operating the place, to pay for my room and board. I got my room and board free from the fraternity. So again, that got me involved with paying bills and interviewing people for jobs. You know, just two or three people we had working there in the dining hall and all. It got me involved with interacting with fraternity brothers, some who weren't too keen on paying their bills, and had to kind of find ways to make sure they did that. Got me involved occasionally with school officials when our fraternity would have us be a little too rambunctious on Saturday night. Got me involved in understanding for the first time in my life that any organization, I guess maybe we had 50 brothers, has many pluses, but has some real bureaucratic things you have to overcome. There's always people who totally disagree on any subject, whether it's how to repaint the house or what food to serve, how loud you can play music, how late at night. And so I got involved in all of those issues and began to see how people can become polarized over trivial issues if allowed to continue to exist and aren't dealt with. And even really good friends become quite upset with each other, and to the extent that, you know, they wouldn't speak for periods of time. And so it was a great opportunity for me to begin to learn how to interact with people and how to try to break down barriers and rebuild a consensus of some sort. As a result of being 2 years as the house manager and the dining hall manager, I was elected president my senior year. So I really got involved with all those things and continued on running the house and the dining hall. College was great for me socially for all those reasons, and it made me much more capable and able to meet people and to deal with issues and to really see the kind of things I was going to face in the business world.
You were at that time confident you would move into business?
Well, so that's the second part of the story I'm going to tell you, because 3 years I was in nuclear engineering. And the middle of my junior year, NC State at that time had a rule which I thought was excellent. No longer have it because I've just gotten off the board at State. But the rule was between your junior and senior year, you had to go somewhere and work at least 8 weeks in the field of endeavor that you were going to pursue. And so starting about the middle of my junior year, I started talking to the deans about, well, what should I do that summer? And they were talking about Westinghouse and other people who were in that field, as I recall. And I said, okay. And I did some interviewing with them. I said, what would I be doing? And they said, well, you know, the main thing we're doing right now is working, I'll describe it in the area of metallurgy, where we're working on the kinds of metals that can withstand the heats and the pressures and alloys, and you'll be assistant to someone who's doing that. And I said, well, wait a minute now, you know, I've learned a lot about people, I like dealing with people, I like seeing results. You mean both at summer and then later on in the job I'm allowed to be working in a laboratory fiddling around with different alloys? And I said, well, that's, you know, kind of where the technology is today. It's not much, there's not much in the way of production and operations. And, well, that made me reconsider the whole thing, because I knew that isn't what I wanted to do with my life after having spent this last 2 or 3 years becoming more outgoing and really liking interaction with people, whether it's, some people are very afraid of conflict and choose to avoid it. I don't want to say I like conflict, but it never bothered me trying to get 2 or 3 people together and say, hey, let's act like grown-ups here and figure out how to solve whatever the issue is. And it became clear to me not too many people were comfortable doing that. Most people like to ignore it and hope it goes away, and of course all it does is get worse. It festers and simmers. So then talking further to deans, I said, you know, I may be wrong, but this isn't really what I want to do. I want to be somewhere where I can interact with people. And again, always in the back of my mind, maybe excessively so, I had never been any good at mechanical things. To this day, I couldn't replace a spark plug in a car if my life depended on it, I'd probably figure it out. But I'm no good at that. We tell the story around my house that when my two little girls were little and they would come to me and say, a toy is broken, the duck won't squeak anymore, can you fix it? And I would say, no, you know, we'll get you another one, we'll get you another one. And about an hour later, they'd be running around pulling that damn little duck, squeaking and acting perfect. And I said, how did you do that? And they said, well, mommy fixed it. And that was that was kind of the way our life has been. She can fix anything, and I'm just not very good at that. So anyway, I concluded that wasn't for me, and so I looked at mechanical, I looked at chemical, I looked at electrical, and I decided to go into industrial engineering. As I talked to everyone, it seemed to be an area that was focused on dealing with people and solving problems in a way that I really understood, because we call it operations research in those days, and it's almost like what people call supply chain management nowadays. But I had a real skill for that. I could look at a problem and just like almost instantaneously see the direction it ought to go. And so I switched the middle of my junior year, I guess, to industrial engineering. Now that worked out great for a couple of reasons, because I had taken so many technical courses in nuclear engineering that I had finished all my thermodynamics and fluid flow dynamics and all of those that were a requirement to graduate in industrial engineering. And so my senior year, I took industrial engineering courses and some liberal arts kind of courses, which not too many engineers get a chance to do. So I really felt fortunate because I'd had the experience in the fraternity house of interacting and dealing with people. I had had an outstanding technical background, and once again, it was very easy for me. I mean, all my colleagues couldn't understand I could make A's on thermo when I couldn't change the oil in the car. But I just could. Mm-hmm. I could see the problem, I could see the answer, and they were fabulous at everything else, but they couldn't understand thermo. So I had the technical background, I had the social interaction, I had my senior year where I could really focus on academics that were of some significant interest to me, but were really very easy. In fact, my grades probably deteriorated. I pretty much all had all A's until my senior year, and I got some B's because there were a lot of subjective courses where you had to write essays and things, and I made much better grades if it was just something that, you know, there was only one right answer and you had to figure it out mathematically. I could always do that. But nevertheless, I ended up with, I don't know, 3.6 or something, and came out of college feeling I had been extremely fortunate in the way the whole thing had unfolded. My high school folks had sent me, you know, recommended and pushed me in the direction of engineering. I tried what was in the new phase of engineering, learned a lot from it, but concluded I didn't what I wanted to do. Switched to industrial engineering, industrial management. Had a year to really focus on what that meant. Without any pressure at all from grades or courses that required a lot of study. And they talked to me about staying on and getting a master's and a doctor's degree because, you know, people recognized I had a pretty good intellect. But I was not the least bit interested. I was itching and getting to work. You know, I had... my parents had been wonderful. They'd helped me with tuition. I paid my way on room and board for the most part. I now had more confidence in my ability to get along with people and to meet people. My wife now, we just had our 43rd wedding anniversary yesterday. We've been dating since the 7th grade, school together. And she'd gone to university of what was called Woman's College back in those days in Greensboro, North Carolina. It's now the University of North Carolina, Greensboro. And I'd gone to NC State, and we were ready to get married and go out and have some fun, and I was eagerly looking forward to going to work. So I never gave any serious consideration. People ask me all the time in my career at DuPont, young folks who are interviewing, should they stay for a master's or a doctorate? And it's a very tough question. You can only answer it. Each one has to look at where they are in their thought processes in their life and what they want to do. to me, it was so easy. I want to go to work. I want to get out in the world. I want to earn a paycheck. I wanted to. To me, going to work looked like fun. Other people are not ready for that, and they want to gain more knowledge or gain more skills or ability to interact. Do you really want to work in a lab, or do you want to be in a people environment? So it's a tough decision for some young folks, but for me, it was very easy. So I graduated North Carolina State. I had been in ROTC, so I had a commitment to the Army. I graduated one Saturday. Peggy and I got married the next Saturday, and the following Saturday we drove to Maryville, Tennessee to go to work for Alcoa. So, and then 2 weeks after graduating, I was happily at work in industrial engineering.
You did find a position not in the laboratory then, or not in production.
Yeah, I interviewed, it was a pretty good year, 1957. It was a pretty good year, not a great year for jobs. You know how in engineering is either feast or famine. Everybody's hiring everybody, or you can't get a job. And we were just about to go into a big recession. People weren't too aware of it, but they were hiring less. And I interviewed AT&T and Exxon and DuPont and Alcoa. I don't know, three or four more. I didn't want to interview a lot. I really wanted to stay in the South. Peggy and I had grown up there. We loved the South. Everything about it, the weather, the fishing, the water. And being here, our folks, we both had big families. Peggy had two sisters and two brothers, and in fact, for years, decades, every time we'd come home on vacation, our family and friends were saying, well, now you're ready to move back home and settle down now? I mean, they never believed we were not coming back to Washington, North Carolina to live. So we didn't want to go stray too far from home. I really liked this plant in Alcoa, Tennessee, Maryville, Tennessee, their sister towns. They were building up an industrial engineering organization because it was a fairly modern plant, but very inefficient. They had a national union there, which was good for me to get exposed to, and they had really inefficient methods. They had modern equipment, but they had agreed to a lot of industrial practices, which were okay, maybe, prior to that, but as they put in the modern equipment, they hadn't gained much from it because the regulations, agreements they had with the union was such that, if it used to take a machine an hour to do a job and now you could do it in 30 minutes, they had handcuffed themselves, so if the crew got through the 30 minutes, they'd sit and wait 30 minutes. So they were trying to change that dramatically. And so they hired, 7 or 8 of us about that time. And we did a lot of layout, a lot of time and motion study, a lot of basically working with the people, not the unions, to get them to understand that everybody would be better off if we used all this stuff efficiently, and showing the people how to do it in a way that really was not onerous to them. I must say, while we were very successful in identifying a lot of improvements, it was clear to me that the management didn't have the courage to insist that they be installed. And while I liked the plant a lot and the people a lot, I'll give you an example. When after about 6 months, we began to really put into some of these new ideas, and some of the more rabid members of the union, well, let me allege this because I can't prove it, but as soon as you put something in, you would find the equipment failing. And it was pretty obvious to me it was sabotage. And so it became clear to me that this company had lots of difficulties, and at that point in time, they didn't have management at plant or above that that was really going to deal with the issues. Great learning experience for me. People would leave machines running, and they'd leave 10 minutes before the shift was over and leave the machine running. So if the tail of a aluminum coil, if it ran out, the coil would just flap all around and damage equipment. And I observed nobody getting fired or no one really being severely disciplined. So I was a little bit disillusioned at that point in time about American industry, or particularly the heavy industry, which we then have seen subsequently, whether it's aluminum or steel or automobile companies, having difficulty to compete. But in any case, as I say, I liked it a lot. After 1 year, I had to leave Alcoa. I learned a tremendous amount. I went into the Army for 2 years, ostensibly, and planned to go back to Alcoa. Well, when I went in the Army, the Korean War had just ended, and they were in one of those periods. I went to Aberdeen Proving Ground. One of those periods where the Pentagon was short of money. So they asked for volunteers who would leave after 6 months instead of 2 years. And they didn't have too much difficulty getting volunteers, including yours truly. Now, there was a penalty. I had to agree to be in the reserves for 7.5 years, as opposed to 2 years full service and nothing in the reserves. But to me, that was a very good deal because I could get back to my career, and I didn't mind the reserves anyway because it made a little extra money. And those days, you know, an engineer and a young family, I didn't have any money. So I made that decision, and after about 3 of the 6 months, Peggy and I went home, Washington, North Carolina, for, I guess we had some days off. I don't know if we call it vacation or not, but you earn so many days off. So we went down for a long weekend. And while there, my friends all told me that DuPont started up a new plant just 30 miles away from hometown. Right outside of Kinston, North Carolina. And they wondered why I didn't go over there and try to get a job if I wasn't going to come back home. So the next morning I rode over with no introduction or anything and just asked, were they hiring? And it was really interesting because they said there was nobody there to interview me that day, but come back the next day. So I drove back the next day and interviewed the number two person in the industrial engineering department, and I found what I just thought was an extraordinarily encouraging environment at that plant. First, the plant was new. It was producing Dacron polyester. It was the first polyester plant in the world. And everyone there was young and enthusiastic about the potential for polyester and all kind of apparel and sails of sailboats and on and on and on, and expansion plans and ideas for the future. They weren't doing real well at the moment because it took a while to get people to accept Dacron in shirts. People were used to cotton. And it took a while to get the whole idea of wash wear ingrained in the public. Which again was a great learning experience for me to see how that takes a while to take hold. But in any case, that day they offered me a job in industrial engineering to help really get the plant efficient, and they were pleased that I'd had a year experience with Alcoa. And so I went back to get my last 3 months in the Army, and after about another month, I got a note from people at DuPont and said, we really need to know if you're coming here or not. you gave us the impression you might, but you haven't accepted yet. So I could tell from their tone that I better accept or plan on going back to Alcoa. So the attraction of living near home with a brand new plant in an industry that truly was embryonic as opposed to the aluminum industry, which not only was pretty set in their ways, but had the heavy union and had lots of difficulties to overcome, which wouldn't have bothered me if I thought the management had really been committed to do it. But the management kept backing off when challenged. And so here was a brand new plant with tremendous upside potential, which turned out to be true, for sure. This polyester has been the fastest growing part of the chemical industry for the last 40 years. Modern plant, really need for new ideas, knew there were going to be future plants. So I did accept the DuPont job, and so I worked at Alcoa for a year and then in the Army for 6 months, and in December of 57 I went to work at Kinston, North Carolina as an industrial engineer with the absolute expectation that's where I'd work, you know, the rest of my life. I was perfectly happy with the idea that I'd be working 30 miles from my hometown. I'd be seeing my family. I'd have a great company, because DuPont has always had a wonderful reputation. And a great company, exciting new field of endeavor, working with people, which is something I was interested in. And actually, we had a little place on the river in Washington, and I commuted the 30 miles every day for the first couple of years. And once again, I felt like I'd been extraordinarily lucky, as I had in high school, as I had in college. I like the idea of working a long time for a company. I still believe that's the way to do it. But I must say, the 1 year I spent with Alcoa, in the 6 months in the Army, when I showed up working for DuPont, I had experiences that made me look much more mature and sophisticated than the other new folks who came into DuPont at that time who had just come out of college. I'd made mistakes at Alcoa. I'd seen other people make mistakes at Alcoa. I learned how to avoid them. I learned how to work with the operating people. I'd interacted with the mechanics and the operators, and it was just really so fascinating to me that the operators who ran the machines would always agree with me that we should make these changes. But the union would tell them not to do it, and so they wouldn't do it. So it was clear to me that if you can explain to people why you need to make change, how it'll benefit the company, how most of the time it'll benefit them in the long run, and how most of the time, even if it doesn't benefit them in the short run, it's not onerous, people are receptive. So that was a great learning experience for me. All these things were very helpful when I showed up at DuPont in December of 57.
Well, you were also fortunate, it seems, that DuPont was willing to wait those additional 3 months for you to show up.
Yeah, that's true. You know, when you're young and certainly not cocky, but knowing you had a job at Alcoa, which I liked. I liked the people. I had made a lot of friends there. Peggy and I liked them. And so I wasn't focused on, hey, come on, Ed, you better get on with what you want to do. I was just kind of nonchalant about it. I guess I knew deep down all along I would accept the DuPont offer. But it's kind of a nice feeling to know you got two options there and you can talk about it and think about it. And but I was impressed with the way DuPont handled it. I mean, they wrote me they were used to dealing with young folks like myself who think they're going to live forever, and everything's going to be okay. And so they wrote me a stern but pleasant letter. You know, we really need to know. We want you, but we need to know, are you on board or not? I've got a good, very good learning experience on how to handle something. I've used that, you know, many times myself. Without being threatening to people, you can give very positive feedback. We need you on this. You're just the kind of person we want. We're counting on you. But you got to step up. So you're right. I was very fortunate that DuPont, there were so many differences that I saw immediately about DuPont and about Alcoa. And most of them were in, the plant was modern and all that, but the people, their concerns for individuals, DuPont's concern for the individual was so readily apparent. Small things. I was scheduled to come to work January 1, 1958. That was a holiday, so it would be January 2nd. The head of the human relations at the plant, not some flunky down the line, but the head of the union relations, and John Page, wrote me a very nice letter and said, "Ed, we're delighted you're coming, but, and it's Christmas and you're just moving back home," because I wasn't getting out of the Army until like the 20th of December. But he said, "You ought to think about this, because if you come the week before Christmas, well, you'll obviously get the Christmas holiday paid. You get the New Year's holiday. You'll get a week's vacation in 1958 that you won't get if you come in January." I guess it was 1 week. And there were several other perks. And he said, you know, every 5 years, the vacation allowance goes up. So every 5 years, you'll have another year's service. So for the rest of your career, well, you know, that was a thoughtful thing to do. It wasn't necessary. But it makes a big impression on a young person that a guy who reports to the plant manager is on the staff, who's 20 years older than me, cared enough about me to write me a letter and say, you know, but if you want to come on the second, that's just fine. We'd like for you to know. Mm-hmm. The other thing that happened after I accepted the job, they wrote me a letter about a month before I got to work and said, you know, there had been some changes in the salary structure and they were giving me a $20 a month raise or a $30 a month raise. Neither one of those things were necessary. Oh, and by the way, the head of industrial engineering wrote me two or three times during that 3 months to tell me what was going on and what areas they wanted me to be thinking about. So it was very clear to me during that time and from the first day I arrived on the job where my new boss, who I hadn't met because he wasn't there when I interviewed, sat down with me, really spent most of the first 2 days telling me do's and don'ts and ideas and explaining to me how polyester worked and the chemistry behind it. When I went to Alcoa, I went in and said, "Here's your desk, here's your pad, and, you know, go out and start doing this." But this was just a much better human relations touch. I'm going to let you worry about the time.
Oh, yes. But when did you begin to migrate toward more management positions or be interested in doing so?
Yeah, during the interviews we talked about that, and I told them that while I liked industrial engineering and felt I was pretty good at it and could be helpful, and that's what they wanted and needed in both of those situations. I told them all along I want to be involved in management. And so I guess it was between 2 and 3 years in industrial engineering. After 2 years, I got promoted in industrial engineering and became a group manager. So I did that for about a year. I had about 7 or 8 industrial engineers reporting to me. And I'd gotten to know then pretty well the plant manager and the head of human resources and, of course, my boss. And I continued to talk about my interest in people and in management. So while I was managing a small group, they agreed and I agreed it would be useful for me to get hands-on management. Now, that plant, like most polymer plants runs around the clock, which means it runs on a shift. The plant never shuts down. You know, these large polymerization units that are very, very expensive to shut down and start up. And so except for a scheduled shutdown for each of the units every couple of years, they produce polyester continuously. And we had about, at that time, we had 6 polymerization units at the plant. So they ran all the time. So to become involved in the operations, you had to work on shifts. And, you know, there were 4 shifts rotating. You worked a week on 8 to 4 shift, a week on the 4 to 12 shift, and a week on the graveyard shift, 12 at midnight to 8 in the morning. So they asked me, would I be interested in doing that? And I indicated I would. By the way, DuPont had then and still has an excellent development program that you could go different routes to prepare you for senior management. So they really didn't want me to go out there, not just me, but anybody in my situation, just to run the shift, because for the most part, the people who operated, who were the management of the shifts, were people who had been upgraded from either operator roles or mechanic roles, who really knew what was going on. But anyway, I accepted a shift assignment. I was a first line supervisor for about a year, supervising the polymerization operation, continuous polymerization, and the spinning operation where the fiber is actually formed, all with a crew of about 30 people working on rotating shifts. So this was probably the best experience I had in the company of really knowing what goes on plants. So many people who join the company and come through the marketing route never really have an understanding of what goes on, what the operations are really about, the troubles they deal with, the solutions they come up with, the motivation of the people. In an outstanding way, or what really irritates them and gets them to not be too cooperative. So I had a great experience there for about a year on the shift operation. We went through the usual kind of difficulties that any fairly young plant does, with things shutting down, and you'd be out at 3 a.m. And one morning I remember one of the continuous polymerization operators came up to me, his name was Ashley, and said, oh God, I forgot to put the catalyst in the holding tank for that latest batch of polymer makeup that we're injecting into the CP. And sure enough, I could look at the charts and see that the viscosity was dropping fast. And so, you know, what do you do? As I recall, I made the decision to dump it in on the line. Turned out that that isn't what the engineers were recommended, but it turned out it worked out great. We only made off-standard product for about 2 hours, and we didn't really have the kind of control that you would like to have, but we would have made we dumped this into the glycol and then injected the glycol into the polymer, but we would have made much longer off-standard product. But, you know, that's not the point. The point is, it's just constantly things like that that you have to make decisions on, because people are people, and, you know, he forgot to put it in, and to his credit, he came and told me right away. I don't know what had happened to him that night, because he was a very, very good operator. But just dozens of experiences where you have to decide mechanically, do you shut down a pump, or do you try to keep running till morning when the new crew is going to be in? Do you call a crew in? What do you do when people don't show up because they're sick? You have to get people in. How do you train people on all the new changes that are constantly being made? Again, a great learning experience for me, because I learned, while everybody liked each other in the manufacturing operation, there was great cynicism of the day people. that the shift people thought that the people who worked on days didn't really understand the issues that shift people had to deal with, and would write them little notes in the logbook saying, you know, do these five things tonight. And while the five things might not have been onerous, people didn't understand why we had to do them. People thought it was a waste of time. People thought it was a waste of money. People thought it was just somebody on days behaving in a bureaucratic fashion. And so I think one of my big strengths is I take note of all these things that I see that cause these kind of issues and disagreements and cynicism, so that later on when I became a plant manager and I was interested in making a change, I would do several things. First, I would typically ask some of the shift people to come in and talk with me, instead of just having our staff get together, talk to me about how they thought this would be received and how would be the best way to do it. Secondly, I would try to always give a very clear explanation of why we wanted to and needed to do it. And then third, I would typically come in like 5 one morning and just talk to the people on shifts to see how it was going and let them know I appreciated what they were doing. So this year, I learned how things go on in the operations, whether it's days or nights. I learned once again, as I did in the fraternity and as I did at Alcoa, that there's a natural polarization between people if the communications aren't good. Even if, you know, if they're fair, you need to communicate much more effectively. And I learned people will do anything in the world for you if they believe in you, if they believe you care about them. And if they believe you will at least listen to their point of view. I cannot tell you how many times in my career, at all levels that I later attained, when I would be talking to people at plants, and they would say to me, "We got some great ideas if the management would just listen to us." So it is a human failing almost that when people get to managerial jobs, they tend to either be too busy to listen to people who are actually doing the job, or get a little arrogant, or for some reason just think that the people on the line just want to complain. And many examples of where, when I was superintendent of a plant before I became plant manager, I would say, I was out there talking to Susan today, and she would say so and so. "Oh, she's just a bitcher. You don't want to waste your time listening to her." I said, "Well, no, wait a minute. She has some pretty good ideas. Maybe she is a bitcher. I'm not saying she's not. But even a bitcher occasionally comes up with a good idea. So why don't we, you know, listen to what she says, and maybe 1 out of 5 of her complaints are legitimate, and we can learn something and do something better." But I have to say, while DuPont has great people, they tend to fall in that trap of, if a person complains frequently, to turn the person off. So after about a year of doing that, I got promoted to shift supervisor. At that time, we had 2 levels of management on the plants. Now we just have 1. And the shift supervisor had several areas where you had these first line supervisors, and so you were more broadly involved across the plant. Now I began to see another, learn about another area of natural interaction of people, and that is Section A of the plant, and Section B of the plant, and Section C of the plant. First, we compete about who were the best, which is a positive, natural thing. But if there was a problem, there would be a tendency to say, well, Section A didn't get us to us in time, therefore Section B couldn't do it right, and therefore Section C got behind. And so again, trying to, in that job, explain to people, hey, look, it's our shift who's doing this job. We all win together, we all lose together. It's not Section A or Section B or Section C. And I made some pretty good progress in that. I shift, you know, our objective was to be the best shift on the plant, to do things well, to have great safety of our people, to have great productivity, great quality, and explaining to people that if Section A had a problem, then it was all of our problems, and we had to really quickly figure it out and help Section A learn quickly. So another great learning experience for me. Well, from there, I went back into planning, not really industrial engineering, but at that time, Dacron was growing so fast that we had a couple of new plants on the drawing board. And with my experience in industrial engineering and then in operations, they selected me to be head of the planning division for all of Dacron. So first I stayed in Kinston and did that, but then moved to Wilmington, Delaware to coordinate the expansion of the plant in Wilmington, North Carolina, and Nashville, Tennessee, and then later on in Charleston, South Carolina. So I left management really for a couple of years to do that. But they agreed, and I agreed, that what I really want to do is get back into line operation. And so we got those plans laid out and humming along. And then I was transferred to another plant in Nashville, Tennessee, the Dacron expansion, as the superintendent of the Dacron business there. So I was in engineering for about three, industrial engineering about 3 years, and I went to shifts for a couple of years, and I came back in industrial engineering type assignment, but really focused on the expansion of the whole Dacron division for a couple of years, and then back into operations where I had responsibility now for probably 700-800 people, maybe 1,000. And really the first big time full assignment I had with total responsibility for everything on the plant. The maintenance of the operation, the development of new processes, the short-term process research, the operations, the safety of the people, the development of the people, and just a great job.
You were pleased with that change in responsibility, it seems.
I very much was. As I've said a couple of times, I mean, I love the planning job. I'd known that since my senior year in college. It was just real easy for me. My mind worked in such a way that I could see how to lay things out in an orderly fashion. And so the company recognized that as well. So in my early industrial engineering experiences, I had been able to help the plant. I had two advantages there. One, I was able to do that well. And the second, everybody else was so busy just operating the plant, they really didn't have time to sit back and figure out how to improve the orderliness, the systems flow, the integration of every aspect of the plant. So I had the time to do that because that was my assignment. But then working with the people on shifts, I mean, I really loved that. I had operators on the shift call me 10 years later. And just every 3 or 4 months, someone would call just to talk and tell me what was going on. So I really developed some friendships with these folks. My wife used to say, you know, if one of your friends on the phone calling late at night one night, they'd go out and have a couple of beers, and they'd call and, you know, talk about work. And this is after I'd left Kinston, asked me to come back and see him. So that was, I knew that was for me, because I was learning these things. It says you have to really have a concern for people, because they can tell. People can spot a phony a mile away. If you come into an operation job and you talk about, you know, I really care about you and your families and I want to learn your birthdays, and people see that as kind of a game. But if you, in the course of interacting with them, you begin to explore what their interests are and what their concerns are, and you offer them some help or some ideas, or they can tell if you're genuine, if you're sincere. And so I knew that was what I wanted to do, be in a position where I could. I loved, as I had from the high school days, playing ball, seeing results. I was never the best athlete on the team, but I was frequently kind of looked to for leadership because I could bring the teams together to achieve things. And so I recognized that kind of as a leadership skill. And so I loved then in operations, whatever it was, whether it was just the shift or whether it was the Dacron plan or later a plan of its own, to have the objective of just being the very best we could be.
During this time that we had this extended fruitful learning period in management leadership, it was all associated with the Dacron production.
That's correct.
Were there chemical innovations that altered the Dacron production during that time, or was it more or less just getting better at doing the same thing?
Well, I guess most of it was process improvements of the latter kind you described, but there were some very significant breakthroughs that I got to observe. And so let me digress into a couple of areas. When I came back from shifts and was in this planning job, first at Kinston before they moved me to Delaware, during that year and a half, I was assigned, in addition to the planning job, to work with the research division of Dacron. Each of the divisions have research laboratories. Fortunately for me, the Dacron Research Laboratory was located at Kinston. So all of the research in Dacron was done right there at the Kinston plant. And so I had two assignments. One of them was the long-range planning of the operations, but the second one was working with the research scientists and the research leadership at the Dacron Research Lab, because we were still in very much the embryonic period of growth for polyester. And they had tremendous number of projects going on. And the management of the division said, you know, we need someone to help screen these things, because another learning I had was scientists will work on something they're very interested in, which may have no commercial applicability at all. And so again, a great opportunity for me, because I got involved with every significant scientist working on every significant chemical engineering innovation involved with Dacron for the next decade, helping them figure out A, the probability of achieving scientific success, B, the probability that we can do that in a cost-effective way, because some of these things we knew we could do, but if they double the cost of the polymer, the cost of the final product, it was not likely to have any commercial application. And three, working with our customers on if, in fact, we achieve this, and we achieve this cost, what would be the potential size of the market. So I not only got the ability, the opportunity to be exposed to all that, I got to really understand how the scientists worked and how they thought about things. And that was highly beneficial when later on I got into senior management jobs and I had to make decisions about moving forward with research projects when I truly didn't understand the chemistry. But I had to make a judgment about the probability of now moving with, you know, $100 million projects instead of $500,000 projects. Well, so the innovations at that time were enormously prolific. There were breakthroughs that were primarily focused on expanding the end uses. And when I went to work there, basically polyester was a homopolymer. We just made the basic polyester. But then our people started coming up with all kinds of copolymers, where you would add a chemical additive which would give you a product that was stronger, or in one case a product that was weaker, weaker tensile strength. So what you were looking for there, when, since Dacron had a propensity to do what we call pilling, you get little knots on your shirt. So if a knits, if you had on a golf shirt, and you got these little rolled up balls, you know, it wasn't very attractive and it wasn't good for the market. So our scientists came up with a product that was less strong, so that what we call the pills, the little balls, would form, but they break right off. We had breakthroughs in copolymers that allowed, made polyester easier to dye. So it was much more attractive for things like men's suits. When I went to work there, polyester was pretty much used in, for the most part, Dacron cotton shirts and trousers. So all this rash of innovation of copolymers was a great learning for me, to see how scientists understood that you can take any kind of polymer, put an additive in it, and totally change all the physical characteristics. So you make it stronger, you make it weaker, you make it more dyeable. Then our people came up with, our scientists came up with an idea that has turned out to be enormously profitable for us. We would take the waste and put it in something called fiberfill, which you made pillars out of. So some of our scientists and marketing people said the thing we ought to do is not just use the waste, but we began to make a line of products that were tailored to make pillows and comforters and sleeping bags more comfortable for the consumer. And so a whole new lines of polymers, all these were variants to polymers, but a whole new line of polymers and spinning conditions which gave you different recovery properties, and so a whole new marketing arena opened up. But actually only DuPont 40 years later still capitalizes on. We have an entire line of products tailor-made for these kind of filling products. Well, that was great, except now we had the waste, but we're making more money and building a better market. So then we came up with the idea, the scientists did, of how to recapture the waste in a unit that remelted the product and broke it down. So again, got exposure to all that. Now that's not quite as sophisticated as the kind of things we're talking about with the copolymers and all. But for me, a young industrial engineering, seeing how much people could change things, Then the next major area of more in the area of improving what we had, but our scientists began to work upstream with the raw materials, because they began to realize that the performance in the operation, the spinning operation, the finishing operations, were enormously impacted by the uniformity of the quality of the polymers produced in polymerization, which was, we were able to demonstrate over time, significantly impacted by the quality of the raw materials, the dimethyl terephthalate and the glycol, and the consistency and the uniformity of the viscosity and the distribution in the polymer itself. So I would say this was probably the best period for innovation of polymer modification, all the way from modifying it to produce a varied range of products, modifying it to recapture and save the waste, and modifying it to provide consistent feedstocks to produce consistent polymers to greatly improve the operation downstream.
You mentioned particularly the fabric and filler utilization to Dacron or polyester fiber. Right. Did DuPont move into the production of polyester for tire cords?
Yes. This was one of the innovations that came up about that time, with very high viscosity products, which were good for tire cord. Paul DuPont was very dominant and a great leader in most of the polyester field. This is an area DuPont management did not move fast enough and aggressively enough in, I think, for the following reasons. Although at that time, remember, I was really a very low-level member of the company. But the word on the street that most of us believed is that DuPont had an enormous commitment to nylon tires. And nylon tires are great tires. And it's another important lesson for me to learn that, as I understand it, at the time, the big disadvantage of nylon tires was they had a problem called flat spotting. So for passenger tires, when you leave your car sit overnight, the tire would deform slightly. It would immediately recover as soon as you started driving it, but the first 100 yards or a mile or so, you would kind of feel a little thump in your tire. And I believe it's true that the management of the textile fibers department, the large textile fibers, which was by far the most profitable and the most successful and the most innovative and really carried the DuPont company for 20-25 years, made almost all the money and the growth and the innovation. I believe they were too long trying to defend nylon tires as opposed to this new concept of going to polyester tires. So yes, we were on the leading edge of inventing that. Had excellent performance, excellent operations, but were slow to expand, which greatly infuriated my friends in the scientific world, because they believe without a doubt that the consumer passenger cars were going to eventually go to polyester, and that the automobile companies would begin to put them on the new cars as opposed to nylon. But there was a lot of propaganda going on about how nylon tires really were the best tires and safest, and that the auto companies shouldn't abandon nylon, etc. And so one of our competitors was very clever and expanded very rapidly and became larger than DuPont. And to my knowledge, it was the only one, only in use, that our competition became larger and more dominant. And they became dominant with the tire companies and the auto companies by saying, "We got the new candy bar." I mean, they totally stole DuPont script book. We always had the new candy bar. And so people always wanted to buy more from DuPont textile fibers, whether it was nylon or Orlon or Dacron or Lycra, because they just knew that next month or next year DuPont would come out with the next version was bigger and better. But we had so many strengths, and nylon was our dominant product making most of the money, that there was a great hesitancy to push this product. And as I say, much to the dismay of our scientists and some of our business people who, dealing with the marketplace, just knew that Dacron was cheaper, less expensive, and didn't have the flat spotting problem. Now, there were many related high tenacity polyesters where DuPont remained and remains dominant in all kind of belts, rubberized belts with polyester reinforcing inside, and fire hose, in anything, ropes and cables where you need great strength. DuPont immediately moved in those, and sewing threads of all kind where you need sewing thread for industrial products, cables where you need real strength. Prior to Kevlar, which came along later, Dacron was the preferred, and DuPont was preferred. But in tire cord itself, DuPont was too slow. We stayed in the business for a long time, made decent money, but we learned a very valuable lesson that once you let a competitor turn the tables on you, as we were always able to do with all our competitors in almost every field, you had the biggest market share, you spend the most money on research, you bring out new products all the time. Well, Celanese did that in the tire cord business. They had the distribution chain. Not anybody was mad with us, but the tire companies and the auto companies said, "Okay, you're the one who's willing, Celanese, take the leadership in tire cord and consumer tires, passenger tires." And we were never able to make that invention that thrust us ahead of Celanese, who had essentially the same kind of products we did, but constantly innovating them using our approaches to marketing, constantly making them a little bit better every 6 months, every 12 months, had most of the market share, and were willing to sell the product always slightly below our expense so they would maintain their position, slightly below our selling price, I should say. A very clever marketing strategy. And as we then, our management at the time, made the decision not to continue to expand, and as the market expanded, we became less and less a factor until we actually withdrew the business from the business about 10 years ago and just really focused on all these specialty markets where high tenacity is important as opposed to tire cord. It was a lucrative market for a long time, but our management was right in one assessment, I think, and that is, when you're in a business that's basically a commodity business dealing with the tire companies and the automobile companies, and there's not room for real breakthrough, it becomes a marginally profitable business over time, and that's what happened to the tire card business. So I personally would say it was a pretty big mistake by our management. It turned out not to be enormously important over time because we never let that company or any company do that again in polyester, and it didn't turn out to be enormously profitable, and we focused on these specialty products where the volume was less but the selling price was higher, the profitability was higher. But I do recall we had three production units on high tenacity polyester, and my recollection is that we eventually shut one of them down permanently because there wasn't enough market for more than two in these specialty areas. So yeah, we were there, but we didn't capitalize on it. But another great learning, you know, which I've preached to our people for the last 10 years, let's obsolete ourselves. Whatever our product is that we're the best in, let's figure out what the next product is and not wait for our competition to do it, and let's be prepared to obsolete ourselves. A good friend of mine, Bob Forney, and I, we worked for DuPont, like myself, for 40 years, PhD. Used to have this little joke, one of our big and best products is titanium dioxide, TiO2, we're the leader in the world. And Bob used to always say, I want us to be looking for the TiO3. If you're not a chemist, you won't get that joke.
Yeah.
But that's what we had to begin to preach after that. That was the lesson. And it was a real split in the department, I was always told, of those people who wanted to push it and those people who didn't. But we invented it. You know, we made the breakthrough in the polymerization that allowed it to happen. The other thing we learned out of all that is these breakthroughs in the 50s and 60s were wonderful because DuPont always had a long lead time, 3, 4, 5 years. We could afford to put a lot of research investment. We could afford to put in heavy investment in a production unit or a new plant. We had patents. We'd make a lot of money. We'd get a head start. But starting about at that time, so this must have been, I'm guessing, the mid-60s, people learned how to emulate DuPont's breakthroughs and bring a me-too product to the market very fast. And so I used to describe it, if they could make a product within a year or two, like our polymer innovation, and all of this really came from, you know, outstanding chemistry and chemical engineering and engineering itself in the design of the factory. But if they could come up with something that was 90% as good and sell it at 80% of the price, they had an entry into the market. Then if they were capable, and they were getting very capable because now universities around the world were turning out a large number of outstanding scientists. DuPont hired them all in the 40s and 50s. I mean, we could get anybody we wanted. But now, you know, the German company, the chemical companies, and the French, and Dow, and Celanese, and Monsanto were hiring outstanding people. And so if they could get in there with a Me Too product, then they could begin improving it, focusing on niches like Celanese did in the high tenacity tire business, and before we know it, they'd be making a product equal to or maybe slightly better in some aspect, not broadly, but in some aspect, whether it be a tricot knit for you know, ladies' underwear or whatever. They would find a target and go in and just work and work, and the Japanese turned out to be really good at that. The Japanese chemical industry and fiber industry was never large enough and didn't have enough money to compete with us, but we would find them constantly coming out with some new product that had some benefit that we'd have to work fast with our scientists, with our engineers to overcome quickly because they would be able to enter a market. And what we found is we had to match it fast. Or we would give them a beachhead that would be hard to overcome. And so this may be a good time to say, in all my management assignments, I always had the feeling, and 90% of the time it was confirmed, that if we would tell our DuPont scientists, our chemists, our chemical engineers, our engineers, we have to have this kind of product within the next 12 months or 24 months at this price, they would deliver. It was a great compliment, and still is, to our people that the management would give them clear, direct goals. While they were always working in breakthroughs in the polymerization area, which have been enormous in the area of engineering polymers, as well as in fibers. While they were always working on the basic science and the breakthrough, if we get a team and say, we got to have this, almost invariably, they would deliver.
It's a remarkable record.
Remarkable. And a great comfort to people in general management, like I always was, to say, we're being attacked in this area. And this isn't right for DuPont to be, you know, in second place, and to give people kind of the challenge, let's get ourselves back up there. And remarkable in the sense that our customers believe that. And most of the time, they had so much confidence in us that they would come to us and say, hey, this is what a competitor is showing us. You know, we'll stick with you if you can match it or do better. That was one motivation, our customer. But the second motivation, to be very candid, because many of them told me this, you know, we're scared to death to leave you guys because you will come out with the next TiO3 and we want to be there.
Yeah.
When whatever it is, you know, so we'll suffer with you here for the next 12 months or so, although in this one field you may not be quite as competitive as you should be, but we just know that you're going to come out with something really great, whether it's a new fiber or a breakthrough in a polymer area that's going to allow us to move into some market we're not in, or allow us to produce it twice as fast as we're now doing on our current machines. And we just got to be there with you. And so, you know, we're married to you for life.
That attitude on the part of the customers and the realization or fulfillment of those expectations must have been great for morale within the DuPont organization.
It absolutely was. And you know, that's another thing that I never liked someone coming in and saying, hey, look at what our competitor has done. You know, I always hated it. But on the other hand, I always liked it because I could go to our marketing people and say, you guys have been asleep at the switch. What are you doing? You know, you didn't tell us we needed this. I could go to our scientists and say, what's the matter? Are these folks better than you? And so it really allowed me the opportunity to say, are we going to be number one, or are we going to become kind of second fiddle here? So you could kind of challenge people in a positive, motivating way to say, hey, this isn't right. We're supposed to be the best at this, and I don't know what's going on, but you folks aren't doing your job. And they love to come back to me 6 months later and say, oh, well, see? We told you we're going to do it. One of the great stories, I have so many of them, but I put one of my really good friends in charge of the carpet business in Europe, where we weren't doing real well in nylon carpet. And we had a review there, and this is much later on in my career. But he told me, within a year's time, we're going to have the best product, we're going to introduce these new products, we're going to have the best quality, and we're going to regain all our market share and gain some. And I said, Siggy, I love you, but you've never let me down, but there is no way you're going to do that. This is when I was head of fibers. Well, about 6 months later, I was promoted and transferred to the executive committee and didn't have responsibility for fibers. And so about 6 months after that, he calls me and he says, are you too big a shot, or can I come talk to you? I said, no, of course you can come talk to me. I assumed he had some problem he wanted some help with. So he came over, we sat down, and he started putting on his charts. He's a German, but boy, he is terrific. Now retired and just did out so many outstanding jobs, but he started putting out these charts, and he said, now I want to show you this presentation that I gave you a year ago, and I want to show you what I promised, and I wrote down here what you said, and I want you to say that we exceeded every single one of these goals I promised you. We introduced these new products, we improved the quality, here's what the customers are saying. And I said, mea culpa, Siggy, I should have known better than to bet against you. But it was that kind of atmosphere that I enjoyed having with our people throughout my entire career.
But I was just astonished when he, you know, remembered to come over and tell me that he wanted to show me he had done it. Well, it's the same way with our scientists. They just, when anybody leaped ahead of us just a little bit, they wanted to make breakthroughs. But all the time, they were working on significant innovations to anticipate where the markets were going. One of the things that I think I was able to do in both my assignments as head of fibers and then later on in broader ways was greatly increase the interaction with customers and the scientists. We used to have people in end-use marketing and in tech service who would talk to customers and come back and talk to the scientists. And I made a really strong, had a strong belief and made a strong commitment that, well, we wouldn't do that. We'd bring the customers in, or we'd take the scientists out there. And yeah, and they could be a marketing person who kind of led the delegation. They were always afraid to have our scientists talk to the customers. You know, what they would say, and vice versa, and what they would commit, and what they would say they could do. But I found the benefits far outweighed the risk of having the direct contact. Now it's something we just do routinely, but it took a lot of effort. Maybe we could take a break here. And
all right.
That'd be all right with you.
Sure. This is the end of side two, tape one. This is tape two, side one, of the interview with Edgar Willard, Jr., June 10, 1999. Let me ask you to comment on changes in the management agendas during your career.
Let me just get a little clarity to hear you talking about, as I see it, are changes in management of the company, or in my experience, or
your experience in your field for what has changed within the company during your management career.
Okay, well, the company has been through enormous change during my career. First, kind of restate in a clearer way, the management style of the company when I joined in 1957 up until 1973, that's what, 16 years, was pretty much our people made great inventions, like our research folks. We patented them. We built big plants. We had the leadership for 4 or 5 years. And this was in every line of work we were in. Dacron, Lycra, Oralon, expansions in nylon, Teflon. And at that time, the company was run by an executive committee. And the executive committee, in all honesty, didn't really know what went on in the company. They were more like a group of investment bankers. And the company had about 12 very independent departments, Textile fiber is by far the largest and most important. And the company was enormously successful. You remember after the war, World War II in 46, so many of our competitors overseas were basically decimated. And DuPont was in a golden era of hiring the best scientists. They came up with spun bonded products and aramid products. And it was just kind of taken for granted that every year or two, DuPont scientists were going to come through with a polymer breakthrough that would either in fibers or in engineering plastics, engineering polymers, or in paints for automobiles, move us a step ahead of everybody. And it worked like a charm for 20 years. The first really big body blow to the company was in 1973 when OPEC became powerful. This happened at the same time that DuPont's competition was becoming very, very capable. And at the time that while there was still room for innovation and breakthroughs in polymers and chemicals, they happened less frequently. And the innovation was less significant. It would fill a gap instead of a whole new area like polyester or nylon or Orlon, Teflon. So in 1973, the price of oil shot up ninefold. There was a shortage of oil. There was a shortage of every kind of raw material that DuPont depended on. It was still petrochemical based and to a great extent. Still had a fair amount of commodity products. And with the competition becoming better, all of a sudden, for about a 2 or 3 or 5 year period, DuPont's earnings declined. And we had never had even borrowed money. And now we were beginning to face some cash problems. Inflation, you remember, under Jimmy Carter and all, just shot up immensely. And so all your inventories and everything cost a lot of money. And the senior management of DuPont went through an enormously soul-searching time. Now, again, my timing was impeccable, either good or bad. After having been through all the operating jobs and plant manager, I went back to Kinston as plant manager in 1972. This is where I'd started in 57. I had gone through all the plants, and I came back assigned as plant manager in 72 and stayed there for 2 years. Excuse me, middle of 71. Back as plant manager and stayed until January of 73. So the golden era was still going on. In 73, I got a very unusual transfer and I went into marketing. At that time, it was almost inconceivable to take a plant manager who spent 15 years in operation and put me in charge of the products group for all of fibers. Dacron, Orlon, acetate, nylon, Lycra. So I was there in 73 when there was this tremendous shortage of products and all of our customers were begging us for product and were willing to pay any price. And I was involved with searching around the world trying to find raw materials to help run our plants. And we were making money like crazy in 73. In 74, when the recession hit, because everybody had built this huge inventory because of the shortage, and then when product became available, there was huge excesses in the marketplace. And in 74, I'll never forget, in September of 74, after a year and a half of trying to find product and help customers, our orders fell dramatically, like 40% less than previously. And this continued for a couple of years. So for a couple of years, our orders were way down, our costs were way up because the price of oil had gone up, competition was doing everything they could, and the senior management of the company was in shock, because while this wasn't only happening in textile fibers, it was happening in every part of the company. Inflation was high, costs were high, prices were down, orders were down. And what it was happening everywhere, fibers had been the mother load. I mean, we provided 60-70% of the earnings for a long, long time. And the executive committee had left all the departments alone. They really didn't understand the customers, the dynamics, the cost structure. I was selected to go into corporate plans to study for the company, and this must have been early 75. What the hell was going on? Was this just a short-term disruption in fibers? Was it a new way of life? So I spent about a year doing a study of the whole fibers department and concluded what was obvious to most of us who'd been around, that the golden era was over and that we could no longer afford to build these huge plants. The last one we built was Kevlar, several hundred million dollars, very expensive cost per pound, and hit the market about this time of highly disruptive period. And took a long time to develop the markets, because all the markets were, you know, industrial markets, where you had to prove to people that this product in its great strength was going to hold up over time and was not going to deteriorate. There was all kind of a transportation markets and airplanes and NASA markets and automobile markets and markets to replace hose and belts, and so it was clear it was going to be a long time, if ever, where we got a payoff from that business. But then all our other businesses were under fire at the same time. So that was the last really big, well, we'll follow the old strategy. We got a breakthrough. We got a new product. It has tremendous characteristics. We'll build a plant. We'll develop the markets. The box great at in-use marketing. And we'll have a long lead time, and everybody will live happily ever after. Reported to the textile fibers management first, which I didn't particularly want to hear, and then to the executive committee and the board of the company that we enter a new era, as far as those of us on this task force were, that that model wasn't going to work anymore. And we had to lower our cost. We had to take out a lot of the redundancy we had built up over the years, like IBM and AT&T and General Motors and Kodak. We were all in the same ilk. We had loads of people who just communicated and wrote reports and checked quality, and we had to begin to reduce the cost. We had to be much more aggressive with making small incremental improvements. And when we had a big breakthrough, we had to be much more demanding and systematic about learning how to do it with less upfront expenses. We'd been through Corfam in the company, and we'd had Kiana, which was not like Corfam, but it never paid off as big as it should. And so the manager knew what we were talking about, and so we had to invent, really, then a new model. And that process took about 10 years, because a lot of the senior management, like senior management in other companies, as I've talked about, IBM and General Motors, just couldn't make the immediate shift. But we began to. We began to work more closely with our customers and with our suppliers. There is a certain arrogance that grows in any company when you've been highly successful for 20, 30 years with a certain model. You know, we saw it in Kodak, who just couldn't believe that Fuji was eating their lunch. We saw it in all the big automobile companies when the Japanese came in with Toyota and Nissan with higher quality and better prices. And we had it in DuPont. fortunately, not nearly as bad, and fortunately, not nearly as widespread. So this began to change, and then unfortunately the markets got better and we started making more money, and in 79 we had another big OPEC crisis, oil crisis, which just really reinforced that we had to make major change. So the executive committee became much more involved with the business. The heads of the departments became much more involved in every decision. DuPont management brought Dave Barnes, who had grown up in Fibers, but had left Fibers and gone to work in a number of the chemical operations, back to head Fibers, which was traumatic because, you know, Dave was a great leader, very demanding, insisted on details, and insisted on having a very rigorous examination of everything we did, as opposed to just, well, let's build this plant, we got this product, we know it'll work, and everybody saying, okay, go ahead and build it, we'll give you $200 million, no more. So Dave ran the textile fibers for about 3 years, and then I succeeded him and learned a lot from him, and learned a lot from being on this committee, a task force in 75, where I saw the company and the change that had to be made. And I became head of fibers then in 81. And following Dave's footsteps, we greatly began to reduce the number of people, reduce the number of projects, focus more on the customers, and depend less on big breakthroughs from our scientists, but insisted on more improvements in variants, and focus more on the processes and operation of our plants. To get, instead of building another plant, we'd say, well, we're going to get another plant out of what we got. The operations we got, we're going to get that capacity. So we put engineers and scientists and chemical engineers and working on all that. It was less fun, there's no doubt about that, but it was first imperative and big payoff. And again, when people began to deliver those kind of results, they felt very proud of responding to a real threat to the company. So we began a little bit in the mid-70s. In 79, with the second threat, we got even more serious. Where I grew up in fibers, the big change really began when Dave came in. And as I say, I tried to follow in his footsteps in 81 and 82 when I was in charge of the department. Now, we went in another recession about the time I came in 81, brought about by the 79 oil spike and the high inflation of the Jimmy Carter era. So our results were not really good in the 2 years I was there in 81 and 82. They began to get very good in 82, but it gave us a great opportunity to make enormous change. And where every plant used to have its own research laboratory at that point in time, we said we were going to have one for each of the major products. So nylon had five plants and five research labs, we combined them into one. Where we had scheduling groups for every division, computerization, and systems were getting better, so we would streamline it into one. We greatly reduced all kinds of senior management, where we had like seven levels of management in every one of our plants, we went to four. We had a plant manager, assistant manager, superintendent, a chief this, a chief that, two on shifts, we went to four. And lo and behold, we found, as people were predicting we would, we got better results. We got better results for less people because communications were faster, decisions were better. There were less people sitting around in meetings room debating things. And while this was great, we actually just scratched the surface, which I then spent the next 10 years doing within the company. Because in 83, I was promoted to the executive committee, and we had 9 people on the executive committee at the time. Dave Barnes and I were the two who had been most involved with operations during this changing period, 79, 80 to 183. So we were pushing really hard for the company just to go further and further in this area of simplifying, streamlining, having rigorous examination of everything, to quit having these endless reviews and discussions. When I went to the executive committee, I was the first member of the executive committee, this sounds really weird, to have direct responsibility for operations. Until 1983, the executive committee met as a group, and they had what was called liaison responsibility for various departments and functions. But they had no authority to make any decision. The departments were independent. They could do anything they wanted to. The liaison would give them advice and counsel. And they had to come to the executive committee for big financial authorizations, like $100 million. But in terms of operation, they had no... The executive members had no authority. So when I became the head of the executive committee, on the executive committee, and I'm just the junior member, the management decided, Ed Jefferson, that he would give me line responsibility for three departments, these feudal lord systems that run things totally independent. So I had responsibility for agricultural chemicals, the medical division, and the photo products division. And it was different because now they had to talk to me and get approval to do things. And they didn't particularly like it, but you know, I'd learned to work with people in all kinds of environments, and we got along just fine. It was clear this was the way of the future. You couldn't have a group of business leaders responsible for the company who didn't know what was going on, who didn't interact with customers, who didn't interact with research people, and just kind of sat up on the 9th floor of the DuPont building and read reports. And everybody knew it.
Were you the only one that had that kind of line responsibility?
I was the only one at that time. And that was true for 3 years. And then we began to give others that responsibility. Because in 86, after I had been there 3 years in that role, and the others continued in their liaison role, Dick Heckert became the CEO, and I became the president, or vice chairman I was called, but the chief operating officer. And so we immediately went to that system for everybody then. First we were reducing the executive committee, so as people retired, we didn't replace them. We got down to about 5 or 6. And each had responsibility, and as we sat around the table, now we had, in that room, people responsible for every part of the company. And by then we had acquired Conoco, and it had a line organization. So we had 6 or 7 people responsible, and we could look and... Okay, James, why is your business doing what it is, and your departments, and what are you going to do about it? And not, well, James couldn't say, well, I'm going to go out and talk to people and see what they think. No. You come back and tell us what you're going to do. So a whole new mindset was introduced. This was big. You know, it sounds simple, but for 30 years, each of these departments had run around on their own, making their own decisions, only telling the senior management and the board what they wanted to know, and only asking for authorizations from the bank to spend company money in investments, in research, or in any other operating expenses, purchases they could spend any amount they wanted to. So this was one enormous change where the leaders of the company had responsibility for the performance of the company and no fooling. And now you had to dig into your departments and find out what they were doing, how much they were spending on research, did you agree with it, were you happy with it, and big debates among you and the head of the department, which were, you know, always resolved amicably, but no longer just the way the department had wanted it. So we did that for 3 years. And I would say this is all comes in phases, the major management changes of the company. But phase number one was the awareness in the late 70s, culminating in the 79 crisis, inflation, high petrochemical costs, which induced the executive committee in 81 to acquire Conoco, ostensibly so we'd never have another shortage of petroleum raw materials, petrochemicals, and because people believe the price of oil was had gone from, you know, a couple of bucks to $9 the first step, and then $9 to $30-some the next step, and people thought it was going to $100 because OPEC was really strongly in touch. By the way, the head of our economics department, which we had at that time and no longer have, assured me it would never happen, that OPEC wouldn't stay together, the price of oil was going to go down, not up. But management broadly, including ours, believed it was going up, and that was part of the decision to acquire Conoco. So the 79-81 period was kind of an awareness. We were in trouble. We had to change. We had to get more involved. I was still not in senior management at that time, or not on the executive committee. That was kind of phase one. And phase two was beginning to have the senior management responsible for the results of individual pieces of the company, which I, as I say, fortunately was the first person to be given the chance to prove that that would work. And then phase three began in earnest in the 86 to 89 time frame, when we began to focus on totally making change of all kind, and it was continuous then, continuous for 5 or 6 or 7 years, always looking to what the next step would be, because we were doing okay, but we knew we weren't as competitive as we had to be. So what followed was, in 89, when I became CEO, I eliminated the executive committee altogether and went to something that was much more like what other companies do, an office of the chairman, and just depending on people to run their business through the line, and didn't have all these quarterly reports and reviews and people coming up and just constantly giving senior management tied up all the time in reviewing things and just saying, now for sure you got line responsibility. And where you had it before, and we sat around and talked about it a lot, you just go do it. We're not going to sit and talk about it unless you need help. So that was important. Then the next thing we did was we eliminated the departments. So then we had businesses. So where Texas Fibers in the past was a department self-contained with functions and and departmental research, but it had in it divisions, we eliminated the superstructure and just said, okay, now we got these divisions. And by the way, these divisions don't report to the same person. So we have some of the divisions, which are the specialty fibers, report to person X in senior management, and the commodity parts report to person Y, because we want to get out of the mentality we are a department and fibers and, you know, don't mess with us. So we had a business, and where we had had a business leader, assistant department head, a department head, an executive committee, we eliminated all those three steps, and we had a business leader and a person who reported to me. And so the business leader had one person between me, the chairman, and CEO, and himself, where it used to be four. So the decision making now could be very clear. The executive vice president and the business leader could talk to me on the telephone. From top in the office, we make a decision, we went. Whatever it was, a new product, a new invention, and a lot of it was just keeping me informed. So we greatly streamlined the operation, so that was part of this final phase. But then we again realized our costs were just way too high. And that became clear because our customers kept telling us, you know, we love doing business with DuPont, you have great quality, you have great people, you have great inventions, innovations, but I can buy it 10% cheaper from somebody else. I can't afford it in this day's competitive world. And that all came to a head my second year as CEO, after we'd done all these other streamlining internally. We made the decision we had to get ahead of the curve and really do this major downsizing event. And at that time, we had reduced over about 5 or 6 or 7 years, about 20,000 people in the company, which was good, but it really wasn't nearly good enough. We still had 140,000. And we had kind of taken what people now call the low-hanging fruit, the clearly obvious redundancies, and as I've mentioned, these levels of management. And that was all good. But we had to make a dramatic change. So then we went through the downsizing phase in real and did the mapping of exercises of everything we did in every business and decided what we could afford. And in 1991, we had a major downsizing, which involved about 15,000 people at one time. And over the next 3 years, we went from 140,000 to 100,000 people, which was really traumatic and dramatic.
It was pretty evenly distributed over all the...
Very evenly distributed. Everybody was involved, and we started with senior management again. Although we had reduced senior management a lot, we started with senior management, and the reductions in senior management, I would say the top 500 people in the company I'll call senior management. We took a higher percentage of reductions there than we did in any other part of the company. But it was in every piece of the company, no fooling, and because everybody knew we had to do it. I guess the most traumatic was here in Delaware, where we had like 26,000 people. And maybe 5 or 6 thousand of them worked in plants making some. The rest of us were just office people, marketing, research, technical service, management, communicators, operations people, information technology. And we cut that to less than 10,000. And DuPont in Delaware had been, people claimed DuPont owned the state. We never did, but it made a nice story. We were very strong. But, I mean, it was really very difficult for the local businesses here who depended on us for everything. I mean, we outsourced so many things, and we made, you know, so many things in printing and publishing and brochures, and even people who supplied plants and flowers for the offices. We just cut out all that kind of stuff and said put in artificial plants, they look nice and you don't have to have people come in. So it greatly reduced costs dramatically, but there were an awful lot of people who depended on DuPont in Delaware that the business just didn't exist anymore. And our people were great. I mean, they identified so many things that didn't add value to the customer. That's what we ask. What is it we're spending money on that the customer will pay for? And they knew there were like a million things that were nice for egos and nice for make us feel good, but it just wasn't adding any value to the customer. So that was kind of the low point for me personally in my career, because we went from 91 to 94 really doing those hard things. And I never went to a cocktail party that I didn't see some member of senior management that I had told, you know, you're a terrific person, but we don't need your job anymore. We cut our information technology costs by almost 50% just by combining. We had information centers all around the world, and we combined the one in Asia and one in Delaware, and consolidated several in Delaware. We had a great leader leading that effort, and she just showed us how to do it by streamlining and telling people, no, you can't have your own individual way of doing it. There's going to be a corporate way of doing it. And we just found we spent a tremendous amount of money because everybody liked having their own reports and their own forms and their own ways. And we had zillions of duplicated computer technology, and we went to two or three and shut down centers. And so information technology is just one that was very clear, but it's the same way in human resources. It was the same way in research. We had a culture that people liked doing things their own way, and I'd seen that in IBM as well when I was on the board there. So people just had to quit having all that. And as I say, people were great. I mean, they came up with these ideas, and they, I set the target, everybody would find another way. So remember I said in the 70s we thought we had significantly reduced our costs, but we just scratched the surface. From 1991 to 1991, we reduced our costs by $3 billion. We spent $3 billion less and produced more product. And this was out of a cost of $13 billion. And about half of that was people, and about half of it was purchases and travel and all the things that go with running big operations, shutting down offices. I remember our paint people telling us they had like 20 distribution centers. This is people who ran the automotive paints where we had distributions. They cut it to 6, reduced all those costs, and found out they could provide better service because the information technology was catching up and the transportation was catching up. And people were anxious to provide services to DuPont that we'd always done ourselves. We did our trucking. We did all kind of services for ourselves that other people, accounting, could do less expensively, faster. That was their feel. They were focused on it. But it was traumatic to outsource it and reduce the people. In some cases, we made joint ventures with people where DuPont people would go in the joint venture, so people kept their jobs, but they weren't working for DuPont anymore. In 1994, we earned $3 billion. As I said, we reduced our costs by $3 billion. After tax, that's $2 billion. So $2 billion of the $3 billion we earned as a company in 1994 was because of these actions we took. Had we not taken, the company would have been in serious trouble. We would have been in threats of takeover offers or one thing or another. We certainly would have lost business and been less competitive. But it was a traumatic look back to see that the success we had in earning in 1994 was two-thirds attributable to the actions we had taken to improve our costs and our operating performance. And this was not some kind of cost reduced by inflation-adjusted numbers. We spent $3 billion less dollars 3 years later than when we started, including eating all the inflation that had come along. So the question was, did we do that in such a way that we destroyed the culture of the company, the innovativeness, the competitive? And we found out, even though people were very hurt, embarrassed, and disappointed that we had to do that, we were able to tell them, hey, look, we did it before we had a gun in our head. You know, it wasn't like General Motors and Ford and Chrysler who were under the threat from the Japanese automakers. It was unlike IBM, who almost lost control of the company. It was unlike Kodak and American Express and AT&T. We saw it ahead of time. We rallied our troops. We explained what we had to do. And you folks did it. And we had a belief that we had to treat the people that were leaving as humanely as possible, with as much respect and as affection as possible, so that the people who stayed, they called themselves the survivors. The survivors felt good about themselves and about the company. And they felt the company had handled it as well as it could, that it had to do it. We helped the people find jobs. We treated them well financially. Certainly the vast majority of them hated to leave DuPont, because DuPont's a great company and a warm, friendly company to work for. But it was always amazing to me then, two or three years later, and I can't say what percentage of the people felt this, but a high percentage felt very good because they left DuPont. A lot of them were doing jobs that they knew didn't have any sustainability. They weren't needed any longer. They were involved in some kind of liaison or communications, or there were three levels of management and you only needed one. And so we helped them find new jobs, and they went into careers, or they went out on their own, and they had financial resources, in some case financial freedom, because the first thing we did was reduce the retirement age and add 5 years to people's seniority and reduce the retirement age. So a person could retire at 53 or 54 or 55 with full retirement pay and health benefits the rest of their life. And they could sit back and reflect and say, you know, I really wasn't happy in that job, and now I can either do something in the community, or I can go back to school, or I can start my own job. And so many people found it a liberating experience after they got through the trauma. And I was really pleased that the local newspaper, who was very negative to us at the time, interviewed a lot of our people. And they were hard-pressed to come up with people that would say negative things about the way it was handled, the way they were treated. And the key to all that was, as I said, that the survivors of the people who stayed left felt a great sense of pride. And so when I stood up in 95 and said, everybody wanted to know, is it over? When is it going to be over? It's never going to be over as long as there's a competitor out there trying to take your job and our business. Never going to be over, but 90% of it's over. And y'all have done a fabulous job. You're competitive. We made $3 billion last year, two of which because of what you did. And without it, we would be in deep sushi. And now we can grow, and now we can spend more money on research and follow these projects. We can start hiring again, college graduates. And the future is bright. And we have leadership positions in every business except one or two in our company. And we have plans to deal with those one way or the other. And they saw that we now had great relationships with our customers, and our customers wanted to buy more from us. And they were very proud of the fact that business after business, we were the strongest, because we'd gotten out of some businesses. I didn't really focus on that, but part of this whole thing was getting out of businesses like making Remington shotguns, which we never had any business being in anyway, in my opinion. But we had some electronic connector businesses that did not demand or benefit from my great expertise in chemical engineering and chemistry and biology and research in general. We had four or five businesses like that we either sold or spun off. And again, the people didn't want to go, but they got in a different environment, combined with another company in some cases, that they were more competitive. So I felt very proud that in 1995, while executing and continuous improvement was really not just a fad but something we had to do, we didn't have at that point any big weaknesses to deal with. We were highly competitive in every business. We were growing. We had done extremely well overseas. We had built new plants in Asia and Europe. We were well positioned for the global economy. We had leveled with our people and taught them the reality of competing. We had a tremendous pipeline of new products in engineering polymers and specialty chemicals businesses, and variants in most of our fibers businesses. The spun bonded businesses had tremendous opportunities ahead and new products coming. Nylon had been rejuvenated. We knew that polyester still had difficult times ahead because the Asians had built so much capacity. And that condition is still going on today. So while we believe we're the strongest and the best in polyester, it really doesn't matter because nobody's making any money in polyester. But, you know, we have the capability, the resources to stick with it until our technical strengths and our market share pays off for us, which I'm convinced it will. We had made enormous breakthroughs in agricultural chemical research, and it led a whole new era called sulfonylurea, crop protection chemical herbicides, that allowed us to put literally grams of the new herbicides on an acre of crops instead of pounds. It was so powerful, and they were non-harmful to people or birds or fish, and it's been enormously profitable for us. And we were beginning to get breakthroughs in the life sciences and biotechnology that gave us great promise for that. So we could see that life sciences were going to become a more and more important part. We've been real weak in pharmaceuticals, and we made the decision in the mid-80s to form a, excuse me, early 90s to form a joint venture with Merck, which was enormously successful. And we bought their half back here a couple of years ago, and our people, DuPont people, invented cardiovascular hypertension drug, which is a whole new state-of-the-art product that is one of the fastest growing drugs in cardiovascular treatment for hypertension. So we had great promise there. So we see life sciences growing, and we have this whole bedrock of polymers and chemicals. We're the best in the world, and we've retained our scientists. I want to make an important point, so. So in 1995, we had been through this enormously difficult period of downsizing, of eliminating some businesses, on strengthening the businesses we had, and we could see the future the following way. This thrust into life sciences, where we had now plans to buy back and did buy back our half of the DuPont-Merck joint venture, which had been terrifically successful. DuPont had been able to attract, when we said we were going in the pharmaceutical business in the 80s, outstanding scientists based on DuPont's reputation and tradition, people believing we would be successful. And it took longer than we had hoped, but we do have outstanding scientists and a great pipeline there. We had these breakthroughs in agriculture, and we've been working on the biological contents there, and we had some real breakthroughs in high content oil, where we learned how to manipulate genes so we can produce twice as much corn oil and corn crops as a natural existing product. So we could see a real future in life sciences. But the thing to me that I felt great about, we had not given up at all, and it strengthened our basic chemical businesses, polymers, fibers, chemicals, TiO2, for example. We strengthened ourselves around the world. Many others are specialty chemicals. So we had two fundamentally great foundations for the future. As we looked around, our competitors had followed different tracks, which I never understood and never liked. ICI split into pieces, Monsanto split into pieces, Celanese disappeared, and then along came Hertz and split into pieces, and Rome Poulenc, the French company, Ciba-Geigy. Dow started into slight pharmaceuticals and then got out. They're still important in ag. But I looked around and said, I don't see many companies that think they can be great in chemistry, polymers, and life sciences. Bayer and BASF are still kind of following that track, but it seemed to me we'd gone through a tremendously tumultuous period and come out being, in my humble opinion, the leader in a company who believes in the integration of chemistry and biology, so that we're well positioned to grow all of our fibers businesses, where we're the clear leader in the world, our polymers businesses, where we're the leader in specialty polymers. We got out of many of the so-called commodity polymers, and in chemical products. We're in fluorochemicals and titanium dioxide. We're the leaders in the world. And we're building this really strong life sciences side, which, while we're not a giant in pharmaceuticals and probably won't be, it's my vision and hope that we will be a leader in the whole biological sciences, in health sciences, pharmaceuticals, in agriculture products, and in food products. And that we have the size and the ability to stay with any up and down in those markets. And the cash flow coming from our very successful polymers and chemical businesses, which most of which we'll use to expand those. For example, just last year, where we were always the leader, we thought we were the leader in automobile refinishes and automobile finishes in general, both original equipment and refinish, we were able to acquire from Hertz their Herbert's paints business, which is one of the leaders in Europe. So while we were focusing on growing in sophisticated things like life sciences, we've taken every opportunity where it made sense to make acquisitions when people are abandoning the chemical industry to acquire strong businesses. And now we are very strong in automotive finishes, refinish, and original equipment, in both Europe and the U.S. and in the technologies, because Hertz had some technologies we didn't have. So that's what's going to be our game plan, to use the cash flow to make acquisitions in our basic businesses to strengthen them. And we did in polyester, and we were going to in TiO2, but the FTC wouldn't allow us to acquire RCI's business there. And in Herbert's in the paints business, use the cash flow there and in modernizing our facilities while building this life sciences thing. Now, to do all that, the financial demands got too great, and we had known for a long period of time that while Conoco, the oil company we acquired in 1981, was an excellent company, well managed, providing us great cash flow and balanced earnings during a period of chemical downturns. And every time we had a chemical downturn, the oil company performed well so that we could keep raising dividends and have good earnings growth. We decided it was time, the board decided, and we've been expecting this for some number of years, that our appetite for life sciences would be such that we would need to dispose of the oil company, which we began last year in 98, and we'll finish here in 99, and we'll have seen an acquisition that we made for about $7 billion in 81, and then we sold off coal and chemicals, and so we have about $4 billion in it. We will realize about $20 billion, which we can use to pursue our aggressive appetite into life sciences. And we've also announced this year that we're acquiring Pioneer, which we consider the leading company in the whole food area, in agricultural area, in biological sciences. So the game plan is playing out once we got through this terrible period in 91 to 94, strengthening our chemical businesses, which we're going to stay with for a long, long time and hopefully remain the world leader in that, sell the energy business, which served us well, but now they can go off on their own and expand Conoco, and redirect the money into life sciences with the acquisition of Pioneer and a smaller company called Protein Technology, which is the leading technology in soybean research, and we see a great future and fit with that into our agriculture business, which has become one of the two or three best in the world on its own. Now combined with Protein Technology, combined with Pioneer, and combined with the human health side of our pharmaceutical business, which is very strong and very profitable, we see that becoming an ever-increasing part of the future. And then, unlike any other company, I believe, we hope that we will learn so much from biology and biotechnology that it's our objective to be the leader in using biotechnology and biology for material sciences. We're already working on biological routes to 3GT, which we hope to commercialize in the next year or two. And while it may be 5 or 10 years away, we see a steady stream of biologically derived products that can replace petrochemical-based products, our polymers and our fibers. So DuPont, I believe, is well-positioned. There will be continued need for streamlining, modernizing, simplifying what we have, but we don't have any weak businesses at the moment. And we, I'm delighted to say, have gone through a transition here from myself to my very good friend Jack Kroll, who ran the company for 3 years, and like myself, wanted to retire in his early 60s. And now we have a CEO, Chad Holliday, who's 50 years old, who can do the heavy lifting for a long time. And a great game plan and good cash and a very strong position in all our businesses. So kind of a very interesting change from the mid-80s, where we had this model of just great scientific breakthroughs, big plants, strong patents, to As one of my predecessors liked to say, we've been trying to teach this company how to win without holding four aces. And I believe now the company knows how to do that, through marketing, through in-use research, through dealing with customers, through making strategic acquisitions when other people feel they either want to separate out of a business or just aren't managing it well. And a highly motivated group of people who have been through a tough time but see themselves as strong winners with a company that's still highly regarded as one of the outstanding scientific companies of the world. We typically, around the world, when they hold polls, do surveys, we usually come out of one of the top five or at least top 10 companies' reputation for science. I'm always intrigued, and they interview about 6,000 engineers every year in Japan for technology, people they respect for their technology, and DuPont typically comes in third or fourth up there with Sony and IBM and Intel and DuPont. We're usually in the third or fourth place. So we have a great reputation, good financial results, and I think a great game plan for the future.
Well, with that kind of record through what one might call in terms of DuPont history, turbulent 90s, with lots of personnel actions, your leadership was recognized with several awards, including the Society of Chemical Industry Award last year. Would you like to comment on your reaction to that particular medal?
Well, yes, I would. I was thrilled. I was thrilled to see that medal because, as you kind of just stated, I viewed it as a commendation for the people of DuPont who have been through this turbulent time, and much less than a medal specifically for Edgar Woolard. And that was, to a great extent, the thrust of my comments the night of the award. Certainly, it requires leadership to make the kind of changes that we made and come out on the winning side. But I've never been much a believer that one person achieves that much by themselves. First, we had a tremendously strong leadership team, the top 10 or 12 people right beneath me, who were constantly pressuring me to let's do this or let's do that or let's do it faster, and serving up ideas of how to do it and supporting, even though I had to, you know, make most of the announcements and make most of the final decisions. But no one would believe the kind of aggressive enthusiasm that our people embraced during that time, because they have great pride in themselves and in the company. And once they clearly understood what we were doing and why we had to do it, the courage that individuals showed in making changes, and sometimes it was a sacrifice for themselves personally. I mean, people come to me and say, you know, my whole division isn't necessary anymore, or the business I'm running really doesn't benefit from being part of DuPont, and you ought to sell or spin it off. I mean, people who said to me, what you're doing is so right that if I lose my job, I'm supporting you for doing it. So the matter was very important to me from that standpoint. The second standpoint that I want to just touch on briefly is, during this turbulent 90s of all this change, I think we, our company, provided more leadership in the environmental arena than any company in the world. We made a decision in 89 and 90, and I went out and made a number of speeches, which are all being made available to you, saying it's time for corporate America and really globally corporate world to provide the leadership in improving the environment. And in the 80s, the environmentalists have made a lot of noise and they've got a lot of recognition, And they've made some very good points about us, in particular the chemical industry, where the chemical industry basically had the concept that we're not hurting anybody, leave us alone. We know how to run our plants and we don't need to tell the world what we're doing and how. And I think we recognized before most anyone else that that was unsustainable. And the chemical industry had to open up, and we had to say, we'll let you come in our plants and see what we're doing. We'll show you what products we make. We'll show you what the risks are and what the benefits are, and we'll clean up our act. In 1989, 1 week after I became chairman, I gave the first of these speeches, and I decided to do it in London because I wanted to have a global setting, where I committed DuPont to about 8 major breakthroughs. Not that we were doing things poorly, but we were more focused on following the law and the regulations. And I said that it wasn't going to work anymore, and I was going to be the chief environmental officer as well as the chief executive officer of DuPont, and committed that we would reduce emissions by 60% within 4 years, and that we would reduce carcinogen, cancer-causing emissions by 90%. And we would set aside land for wildlife habitat, and we would take all heavy metals out of our polymers, and several other very important initiatives to greatly reduce any deep wells we use, putting stuff in the ground, although we thought it was safe. And it was really a fascinating time in that regard, because we were doing all these other things. And a lot of people, even chemists and scientists in our company, said we couldn't do those things. And I had a great retort, well, I've committed us to do it because I got more confidence in you than you got in yourself, and I just go do it. And it was great for me that they did. In the last 8 or 9 years, we have increased production by 40%. And we have reduced all kinds of waste and emissions by 65%. We're making 65% less waste than we were with 40% more production, not adjusting it for the 40%. We've met all the goals we set for ourselves, and the astonishing thing is the vast majority of the improvements turned out to be economical, as I hoped and suspected they would be. Once again, my confidence in the scientists in DuPont and the engineers, when we said, we're not fooling, we've got to reduce these emissions, they found ways to change the process, redesign the models, reduce the emissions for much less investment and much less cost. In some cases, we actually improve the cost. And of course, you know, you get the benefits of not making the waste, which is just money thrown away to start with, the raw materials. And so now we spend less money on environmental than we did then. We spend less investment and we spend less cost, although we're producing more. And a couple of our engineers just authored a book on how we did it. And they came by and gave me a copy and very proudly said to me privately that they knew this all along, but the fact that I committed us to do it forced the business people to come to them and ask their advice and help and direction, and allowed them to fulfill their vision of doing the right thing. And I'll say kind of here in closing that there's been nothing in my 40 years of experience with DuPont that brought more pride and cohesion and enthusiasm to our employees than what we've achieved in the environment. They didn't like going to school and having people say, why do you work for a company that pollutes? They didn't like their children coming home and say, why is DuPont considered a polluter? And while I do believe, as we always did, that we were not doing anything that was harmful, we're so much better today, and the atmosphere is so much better. And after about 4 years of progress, the person that I assigned to run it, Paul Tebow, who just did an outstanding job, came to me and said, the business leaders of DuPont want to commit to a goal of zero waste and zero emissions. And I got a lump in my throat and my heart because I said, I'm reluctant to do that. And they said, we want to do it. We believe it's possible, just as we're committed to having no injuries on our plant. And we do from time to time have an injury, but we believe we can operate everything in our plant with no injury because we're the safest company in the world. And we have very, very few injuries. And all the benefits that have accrued from safety, we want to take the next step. You've got us 60% of the way there. We want to commit to going to zero. And we're not going to put a timetable on it, but we know we'll keep working at it, and every year we'll get closer to it. And some of our plants will get there. And as long as we have it as a goal, we'll find a way to get better and better and better. And they did, and we did. And 65 of them signed something. I said, I want to hear from everybody. And they went out and got a letter, and 65 of them signed. We're committed to doing this before I would announce that was our goal. And I personally won several awards for committing the company to zero waste and zero emissions, but I said repeatedly for the record, it really wasn't my idea, and it scared the hell out of me. But the people wanted to do it, and they will. They'll make enormous progress. So I saw this medal as kind of the culmination of the great turnaround, another great turnaround in our company, because our company is the oldest on the New York Stock Exchange. It'll be 200 years old in 2002, just 3 years away now. And it's shown great adaptability, great flexibility, the ability to attract and motivate terrific people. But we went through a decade where we had to totally rejuvenate our people, reduce a significant amount, get out of some business, strengthen some businesses, do it at the same time. Our safety performance last year was the best in history, although we've always been great. Our environmental performance was the best in history. So to achieve those kind of environmental improvements at the same time we're strengthening our company, reducing cost, improving our quality dramatically, and making all our businesses world class, and preparing to move aggressively into life sciences, that's to make a person feel a great sense of pride. And so I accepted the SCI medal on behalf of all of our people, and was proud to have been the leader during that period.
I'm watching the time, and just for a few sentences comment, I would like for you to tell me something about your family. I see we have family pictures in your office here.
Yes, I have an enormously supportive family, and I have two daughters. One's married, and I have a granddaughter, 5 years old. My wife has just been a great part of the family and the DuPont family. She is very gregarious, wonderful hostess of everything as I was coming along. And I had the great privilege of the last 10 years of traveling for DuPont and meeting with presidents and kings. And she's as comfortable interacting with the King of Spain as she is with the hat check girl in the hotel. Just has a great way about her. And I always tell the joke, which isn't a joke, when I receive medals that she's always been such a great supporter because she knew whether to kick me in the butt when I was getting too cocky or pat me on the back when times are tough. So I was very lucky to grow up in the period I was and to go to work for DuPont, but to have a wife who in those days was happy to raise a family and to be a part of my business life at every level right on to the day I retired. And I must say that she again was kind of the motivator for me retired at age 61 because I guess I kept going, but she said, hey, it's time for us to do more with the family. And she influenced me that was the right thing to do. We have two wonderful daughters who have just been a great source of happiness and have really never done anything but been their own folks. One lives here in Delaware, not far from us, and one with a granddaughter, and my other daughter lives in New Orleans now. She lived here all her life, but she got married about a year and a half ago, and they moved to New Orleans and are just as happy as two young teenagers. A tremendously supportive family, and I've had great fun with our five-year-old granddaughter. When I retired, people kept asking me what I was going to do, and I was quoting the Wall Street Journal saying, well, I expect to spend a lot more time playing with Caroline. She was only two at the time. But yesterday, we went swimming together in the pool and had dinner together last night with my daughter and wife and granddaughter. So I spent a lot of time doing that, and church is a big part of our life, and we all go to church together, and now Joey has taken our places. We're going to London next week, and my daughter and granddaughter and grandson and son-in-law are going, Peggy and I. So she's fortunate as well, because she gets to see a lot of different parts of the world and different experiences. I said early on in my life that there were three things I was going to focus on, and I wasn't going to put them in any priority, and I was going to try to have a balanced life, which included my family, my job, and my church. And for that reason, I never, played golf or tennis or fished or hunted or played poker with the boys, except on rare occasions. I've never spent much time doing any of those, although I have done all of them from time to time. But weekends were pretty much for the family. And I have tried to balance my life along those three things. And when it got out of balance, I could count on my family to say, hey, wait a minute. I don't remember what the deal is here. And I tried to respond to that. It would really be difficult, I think, to have the kind of jobs I've had and do the things I did without great support from my family. I also like to tell the anecdote that when I gave the speech that I've talked about in London in 1989, my oldest daughter read a lot of my speeches and gave me comments, and so I asked her to read this one before I did it, and her reaction was, Dad, this is by far the best and most important speech you've ever given. I have just one question. I said, what's that, Annette? She said, do you believe what you're saying? Well, that was an enormous wake-up call for me. If my daughter, who we've shared so many things and totally believed each other, questioned whether I believed that I was going to make this kind of personal commitment to the environment and commit DuPont to it. That if she was asking me to confirm that I really believed it, or I shouldn't say it, what other people, both inside the company and the skeptics outside the company, would believe. So I got a lot of great feedback from my wife and my daughters on everything I do. Every time I give a speech, my wife always, for the most part, tells me the good part. And one night in Chicago, I gave a talk to a group of our marketing people, and I sat down and she said, boy, you stunk tonight. So always good feedback, sometimes more frank than I liked, but I knew I could count on it to help me in whatever endeavor we did, and we kind of did it together. And she's she's probably the world's number one tennis fan, and she's done a great job. She's on the board and chairman of the museum of the International Tennis Hall of Fame in Newport, and she's totally renovated that. And so we've always kind of tried to carve out a couple of things like that in the Delaware Art Museum, where she has great skills and great interests, that I could be supportive of her. So it's been kind of a mutual thing, but obviously I've benefited more than they have. But also, my wife got to travel a great deal and to see parts of the world. And she has a mosaic in our game room of her playing tennis in maybe 30 countries with different people, friends and strangers, and she met, who don't stay strangers long, that she communicates with. So we tried to make it a really fun thing for the family, and for the most part it's been, except she'll tell you the 91 to 94 period were pretty miserable for the family as well, as we were, you know, reducing people and facing really tough times. But for the most part, I think all of them would say it's been great fun, and it's been, we tried to make it a family affair when we could.
Right at the outset of this interview, you remarked that as a high school student, you had always enjoyed reading accounts of successful people. I want to thank you on behalf of the Chemical Heritage Foundation for adding a story that maybe some other high school student will read and be inspired. Thank you very much.
If just one person did that, it would be worth it.
Thank you. This is the end of side two, take two, of the interview with Mr. Edgar S. Willard, Jr. on June 10, 1999. The interviewer was James G. Trainum.